And welcome to the Climate Minute, your source for insight and perspective on global warming news. My name is Ted McIntyre, and this show is being recorded when the carbon dioxide levels were 417.46 parts per million. You can go check that on a data table, and it's either January 22nd or about 5 million years ago. Anyway, I want to talk a little bit about the following thing. If you're listening to this podcast, you probably appreciate there's an energy transition underway in our country, right? We're moving towards greener and cleaner electricity. There's a lot of players in that. There's new technologies, there's new companies, there's new ideas, a lot of old players. There are the natural gas people, the utilities, et cetera, that are all vying to be a participant in the great future of the way we run our energy systems in the year 2030 or 2050. In that system, it's recognized that hydrogen is a useful tool. It is a tool that can help us, but it's a two-edged tool. It can hurt us and help us. And it seems to me that right now there is a bit of a contest going on to define language around hydrogen and how society in general looks at hydrogen. And in fact, many of the big moneyed utilities and corporations are trying to take over the idea of hydrogen as a means for them to essentially greenwash. Because when many of these big companies talk about hydrogen, they're actually talking about hydrogen that is derived from fossil fuels, in which case it's essentially as bad as burning the fossil fuel itself. And that's why, if you're paying attention, you'll hear that there's lots of different colors of hydrogen, right? There's this whole rainbow of different kinds of hydrogen you'll hear about, from blue hydrogen, green hydrogen, brown hydrogen, pink hydrogen. And that's all related to the methods by which the hydrogen is made. Generally speaking, green hydrogen is made using renewable energies and has no carbon dioxide output. Most of the other technologies do produce carbon dioxide in making the hydrogen. So there's that's the point, right? Who gets to define what we mean when we say hydrogen is an important deal? Recently, we've been talking about hydrogen on a lot of our shows, if you've been following it. We had some guests on that talked about the possibility that utilities would be adding hydrogen to their natural gas mix. And at least in here, I mean, that's a bad idea for several reasons, not the least of which is that when the utilities talk about putting hydrogen in your natural gas supply today, they're talking about hydrogen that's derived from fossil fuels. So basically, it's a net loss. But there are other ways to make hydrogen, mostly through something called electrolysis, a process that uses renewable energy to turn water, break up water, and get the hydrogen out of it. That's a good thing. Anyway, because we like to think big here, the question is, what could you do? How could you use truly sustainable, correctly produced hydrogen in order to make a transition to a sustainable future, right? Those are good ideas to at least contemplate. And to that end, we are pleased to have with us Professor Nathan Phillips, who teaches at the Boston University Department of Earth and Environment. He is a friend of the show, and I dare say a big thinker. So we're pleased to have him with us. How are you doing, Nathan?
I'm doing well. Thanks for having me, Ted.
That's great. So I just gave that little preamble, and I guess I'd throw it over to you and say, do you agree more or less with what I said? And can you talk to us about, you know, one of the potential ways that hydrogen could be used in a way that is life-affirming and better in the long term?
Absolutely. And even that green hydrogen, if we start there, the hydrogen that you said is produced by splitting water, electrolysis, using renewable energy, wind turbines or the sun, even that can be used badly and can end up helping the fossil fuel industry if we dribble it into pipelines, if we blend it into pipelines and squander it that way, rather than to use it as a potentially precious resource for supporting the electric grid. The electric grid, which has its ups and downs on a daily basis and on a seasonal basis. There's times when there's plenty of electricity. There's other times when there's hardly any electricity at all. It gets really expensive. It gets really cheap and or affordable, even down to zero or negative dollars for electricity on the electric grid. It's astounding. And so
did you just before you, let me stop you there just for a second, not to interrupt your train of thought. Can you talk a little bit about what negative electricity prices is? Because that, I mean, that's something you got to wrap your head around, right?
Yeah, totally. Yeah, and some people will say like, oh, that's exactly how the electric grid market is supposed to work. But actually, it's a big market failure. And what happens if you imagine like wind turbines spinning at 4 o'clock in the morning on a late spring day or in a fall shoulder season, there are these times in which the renewables on the grid are flooding the system in relation to low demand. And what that does is it puts so much of electricity on the grid that it oversupplies the grid, and they're faced with a situation where either they have to turn off the renewables, like curtail the wind turbines, or they literally have to pay people to take the electricity off, like you pay people to take the garbage away from your house. So it's not a good thing for the renewables on the grid. It undervalues them and even devalues them when the prices go negative.
Interesting. Okay. So please continue with you were describing that circumstance and keep going.
Yeah, sure. So there is this rainbow of colors that you had mentioned with which your previous guests on a couple episodes from the Gas Leaks Allies really showed how many of these colors, you know, are really clouding the issue. And that there's a huge greenwash regarding hydrogen with basically laundering fracked gas and putting a color on it and that kind of thing. You know, the better thing to do would be to just describe the way the hydrogen is being made. That would be more clear to people. And there's one part of hydrogen. So the green hydrogen, we could call it renewable electricity hydrogen. You know, we could also refer to electrolytic hydrogen. That would be any hydrogen that is produced using that electricity splitting water thing. That is a descriptor that people, they might have to look up what electrolysis means, but it's more descriptive of what actually is how it's being produced, right? Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, among all these colors and names, I had noticed that, you know, there was not one that refers to what we in the Gas Leaks Allies started calling grid hydrogen. So grid hydrogen would be hydrogen that is produced electrolytically, as you mentioned, splitting water and using the electricity from the grid. So this is something that laboratories in, for example, Greater Boston do every single day because they produce hydrogen with units that are on lab bench tops plugged into the wall, and they're generating hydrogen for their gas chromatographs, for example. That is grid hydrogen. Okay. Grid hydrogen could also be hydrogen that is generated by any means and then deployed to the grid using fuel cells. So fuel cells will do that electrochemical conversion of H2, the molecule, whether it's in gaseous form or liquid form, takes that H2, combines it with O2, oxygen from the air, producing H2O, water, as exhaust, plus electrons, electricity. And so that's how you could store green hydrogen or store grid hydrogen and then re-put it back onto the grid at a judicious time, a valuable time, a time when it would compete against fossil fuel peaker plants take advantage of both ends of this spectrum of prices on the grid. The devalued times when grid renewables are devalued, that's when you would generate grid hydrogen, and that could be green hydrogen too. And then, you know, the other side of that seesaw is putting it back onto the grid at times when the prices are spiking, like cold snaps, extended day cold snaps, or heat waves when the grid prices are soaring and when fossil fuel peaker plants are coming online.
So let me, that's really an interesting way to manage both ends of the pricing extremes on the grid. But I guess I wanted to go back and touch on, just to sort of restate the fundamental idea, that we're using hydrogen to store energy, which, if you're not a scientist, seems like a weird term. But you can easily think of the gasoline that you're putting in your car as containing stored energy. And when you burn that gasoline in the engine, it provides the energy to make your car go. So that in that sense, the gasoline is just a carrier for energy to get into your car. In the same way, Nathan, I think what you're saying is the hydrogen is just a carrier of electricity, of energy, and you can use the electrical energy and kind of store that electrical energy in the hydrogen, hold it for a later time, and then convert that, the energy stored in the hydrogen, back to electricity at a convenient moment. And that's the underlying, it's basically you're essentially storing the electricity, which of course is the words we use, but oftentimes people zip over. So what you're saying, let me just to repeat back, you're saying when the price of electricity goes negative, and presumably that's being flooded from renewable energies, but the price of electricity is negative, that's an opportune time to store that electricity into hydrogen and hold it for some future day when it's hot and humid and you want clean electricity to run your air conditioner and use it later on, right? That's fascinating.
Exactly. And that the negative prices are the extreme case. But in reality, what it is that as prices go low and zero and negative, there is that realm where renewables are becoming devalued, weighed against the prices as they get higher and higher in the winter. So it's more of a continuum type of thing. But clearly, the negative prices make it clear that, you know, there are problems with, you know, renewables on the grid and their value.
So that's interesting. What you're saying is when the price on the grid gets low enough that it's useful to convert that energy into hydrogen to resell when the electricity prices are higher, you could make a business out of that, right? You could do the arithmetic to say this makes financial sense, right?
Indeed. And more than that, you know, it's like that stored energy can be resilience for a site. So for a backup generator, an emergency generator, for example, you've got stored energy on site. And if you had a solar array, or, you know, you could, for example, you know, allocate 80-90% of your renewable energy to direct use or transacting with the grid with the electricity. And you could say, like, you know, I'm going to dribble 5 or 10% of this into my hydrogen storage, squirreling it away for, you know, a freezing day. So there's really a continuum of possible uses, you know, for the renewable electricity and how it transacts with the grid, how it stores hydrogen. And this is, I think, a level of nuance that, you know, when you say grid hydrogen, people don't trust the grid and they don't trust hydrogen. You put those two things together and people are like, what are you talking about here? But, you know, if we just step back, a half step back, you know, I saw that the Sierra Club, National Sierra Club, has endorsed in their most recent report that we should look at using green hydrogen for storage and, you know, generation later of electricity. So they have said that. An Earth Justice report that came out 6 months ago said that is one of the few areas worth looking at, is green hydrogen for storage and electric support. Okay, so what I'm jumping a half step beyond that to grid hydrogen, saying, okay, what we all need to talk about is who is going to do that? And if they do that, how are they going to put it, presumably on the grid? And who will own and who will benefit from doing that? And, you know, what I see from some, you know, is that, yeah, someone should do that. Someone ought to look at that. But I think we have to look at it, because I think there is some reasons that the powerful interests that are there today don't want to look at it. It would be very, it could be very disruptive to the grid if hydrogen started going onto the grid by anyone, because when would they put it on the grid? And what would it compete against if it were put on the grid according to the market's own rules? And when would it be taken off the grid, produced from the grid, if it operated according to the market's own wholesale price rules? And so I think these are very important questions for everyone to be thinking about. And you know, asking not necessarily how can we do it, how can we do hydrogen, but maybe asking, why isn't anyone else talking about doing grid hydrogen? Why aren't the big utilities talking about doing grid hydrogen, putting their green hydrogen on the grid? I just saw a thing about a Vermont utility today. They're talking about blending it into pipelines. Very bad idea, as we've heard from previous guests on your show. You know, they talk about, well, maybe one day we might use it for, you know, electricity support. But I think the time to be talking about this is really now.
When you say destructive, you know, sort of damaging to the grid, I think what you're meaning is to the financial operation of the grid, right?
Oh yeah, I didn't say damaging to the grid. I said disruptive
because the people, for example, and let's just name names. We have ISO New England. We have the utilities. They're in charge of. They're making money from that. And if now you have more players on the grid, I mean, this is an interesting question. It's like, who would in a world that's just and democratic, where there's energy democracy in quotation marks, how would that work out? Would I have something, you know? If the electrolyzers were cheap enough, and someday they will be, right? At some point, the technology, the electrolyzer being the thing that takes the green energy, the green electricity, and makes the hydrogen. Would everyone have their own electrolyzer and then send it back to the grid? Would it be like a town have it? Would the utilities, will we stay with this sort of peaker model? So there's a big electrolyzer at something like a PVD peaker plant?
Yeah, so what they're talking about right now, when you see any of the big players, corporate players, talking about what they would do that relates to the electric grid with hydrogen, they're talking about combusting it in big power plants so that they can blend it with their gas into their electricity power plants. It's kind of the analog to them blending their gas into the pipelines to combust. So that's the way they're orienting towards, hydrogen for grid support, is the big combustion turbines. Now, we know that those produce a lot of problems with nitrogen oxides. Even if it was 100% hydrogen, you've got problems there. But also, you know, that allows them to continuously blend and muddy the waters with their fracked gas plus little bits of hydrogen into these combustion turbines. The thing that they're not talking about is fuel cells, because fuel cells and electrolyzers with fuel cells scale really all the way down to the benchtop in a lab. Okay, so in principle, it democratizes production, storage, and dispatch of hydrogen across scales. Okay, now, then, so in
across scale, again, you mean scale from a home up to, you know, yes, a big power plant. I mean, that's right, the scale, right, you're talking about. Yeah,
exactly. Like, you know, you or I can't frack in our backyard, and we can't drill, you know, but we could, in principle, we could put solar on, we could do some battery storage, we could even generate hydrogen in principle. I think where this comes down to is legitimate safety concerns about hydrogen. It's an explosive, flammable gas. It's stored at thousands of pounds per square inch. And so, you know, that is something that has to be really, really foremost. You know, people talk about the cost of electrolyzers and fuel cells. That's not the issue. They're scaling rapidly. Prices are dropping. They're on the same cost curve as solar and wind themselves as technologies. So it's not that It's the storage. That is the biggest issue with hydrogen. And for those reasons...
Essentially, forgive me, Nathan, but it's essentially having, you know, a big tank of... It's like having a big tank of gasoline in your backyard, but also roughly equivalent to having a big tank of gasoline in your automobile, right? There are ways to do all these things, but it is a serious issue, the safety.
Yes.
But one other question I had is just for the people who may not click... To my mind, a fuel cell basically is the ones that I have seen are typically, they're sort of like the equivalent of a laptop battery in the idea is it's about a foot square, couple inches thick, and has the two little gas connections, and it can sit on your tabletop. And that in the same way that your laptop battery that Elon Musk has hooked up all your laptop batteries to make a Tesla, right? You can take lots of these little tiny squares. And basically it's a very simple, there's no moving parts. So you put the gas and electricity in on one side and you get water and hydrogen out the other, or you go reverse the process and put the hydrogen in. So it's these very simple things, but that's the, when you say fuel cell, just for that somebody's not, doesn't know what a fuel cell is, they don't freak out, right? Is that description totally fair?
Absolutely. You know, the key thing I say about the electrolytic hydrogen and fuel cells, there's no combustion. There is no, you're not burning anything at any point. The fuel cell, instead of burning hydrogen and creating, you know, high heat and nitrous oxides and all this stuff, it's electrochemically getting that same reaction done with the H2 plus the oxygen to form H2O plus you get your electrons out of it. So it's no combustion and no emissions, which makes it very, very attractive to do. Yes.
And that technology is rapidly getting better, right? People have been talking about fuel cells for a while, but I mean, the technology is improving and we're at a position where we need to sink money into it probably to make them ever better, right?
Yeah. And you know, one thing I just want to point out is you hear an argument about efficiency often, like electrolyzers are not efficient enough. You're wasting a lot of electricity when you take that electricity and create hydrogen from it. But I want to point one thing out. You know, when the grid prices are low or zero or negative, low efficiency operating on zero or negative prices or even low prices creates value when there was no value at all. Okay, so if you use a nominal value for electrolyzer efficiency at a very low grid price that might be under the conditions we were talking about, like $1 a megawatt hour, you're making hydrogen at about a nickel a kilogram. The Department of Energy says we need to get down to $2 per kilogram to make hydrogen viable.
Oh, really?
They're always using these fixed static prices. And my point is prices of electricity are not static. They move and they move in very, very big ways. And so if we or someone were to take advantage of the dynamic grid pricing, the grid's own wholesale market rules, their spot prices, the real-time prices, day-ahead prices, capacity market prices, that those prices are not static at all. And I put it this way, like, you know, wind surfers that are riding on the wind never complain about all of the wind that they're not capturing. Okay, they're doing fine. So if you have an electrolyzer that's half as efficient as the one I mentioned, well, instead of 5 cents a kilogram, you may be paying 10 cents a kilogram for that hydrogen. Okay, with half the efficiency. Let's call it four times. Maybe it's 20 cents a kilogram because you have the most inefficient electrolyzer ever made. Mm-hmm. If you compare that with dispatching that hydrogen with a 50% efficient fuel cell in February cold snap when the prices are $200 per megawatt hour, you're talking about like subtracting $4.50 a kilogram of hydrogen, what you've sold at, with either 5, 10, or 20 cents a kilogram that you generated it at.
Right.
So the efficiency on the on the production side is not really the way that it's being made out to be as, right, like right. The total round trip efficiency just doesn't make this worth doing.
Right. So just to so if we've talked about the fluctuation of the market prices. It's my understanding, I think I've been to this site. There's a site called ISO New England, ISO-NE, and they have graphs that are real-time graphs of what the price is. So, dear listener, I mean, if you want to go see this fluctuation, you can look it up, right? Right, Nathan? Am I correct?
Oh, yes. Every 5 minutes, it updates. It turns out electrolyzers are faster than the market moves itself. So the electrolyzers, if distributed, could really kind of like beat the market at its own game.
I mean, like those flash traders on Wall Street who they're a microsecond. But I mean, I guess the point is these fluctuations that you're talking about are not abstract things that are hidden behind some cloud, right? There's something you can see on the internet today if you want to go look at it.
That's true. And they're so intuitive because they make it like the entire New England region, tens of thousands of square miles, are color-coded according to the price. Uh-huh. So when you see that it's like yellow or orange, that tells you immediately, anyone, like, oh, it's really pricey, very carbon intensive right now. And then other times it's colored where the prices can even go negative. I've seen it several times, or very low. The funny thing is, for as intuitive as that is for everyone, you know, basically there's a myriad of rules and regulations behind that that limits who can actually access those prices. And so this is also a struggle over who owns the grid, who's allowed to benefit from the grid, how do we democratize the grid? Because one thing, I don't know a ton about all of the market rules and regulations, but one thing I do know is the grid, the electric grid, is one of the most anti-democratic institutions that we tolerate every single day. And the funny thing about the grid is that although we can say practically that, yes, the few own the grid, in fact, there is no, we can also assert, we can assert that, you know what, we own the grid. We will own the grid. This is a grid that should be for the people. We should own it, and it should serve us, and we should benefit from the grid, the many rather than the few.
I mean, this then, so now we've departed from fuel cells and technology to politics, but you're absolutely right. The utilities were granted a monopoly in the early part of the last century when that was a reasonable thing to do. And now here, 100 years later, we have this broken business model that basically enriches the few at the and the few are the people who own stocks in the investor-owned utilities, right? And the time has come to, I mean, it seems, you know, it's not crazy to say, yeah, the time has come to change that business model and that the people to democratize, in a literal sense, access to an understanding of that grid and to reorient the priorities of that grid. Because, I mean, even the roadmap bill that was just passed changes the Department of Public Utilities here in Massachusetts to prioritize. So the DPU, Department of Public Utilities, works with the grid, right? It doesn't own the grid, but it works with the grid. And in making decisions, it now has to think about cost, reliability, and greenhouse gas emissions, right? Now but the same thing needs to be extended to all of these utilities that have been granted, like Eversource and NSTAR, that have been granted a public monopoly. Time to take that public monopoly back, in my humble opinion, right?
Yes, and there are provisions and there are ways in which people can entities can aggregate their power and then become an entity which transacts on the grid, for example. So there are ways to think about, democratizing the grid using its own rules. The thing I think about green and grid hydrogen is that it may enable, but in no way guarantees a democratizing effect on the grid. Because it enables it because electrolyzers and fuel cells can scale down to the level of the household if it were safe.
Right,
okay.
Right.
At the municipal scale or business scale, whatever. So it's a technology which enables it, but it doesn't guarantee it, because if no one does it, or we're averse to doing it, it could be that the other option, which is that the big companies and the big corporations, they burn the hydrogen, these combustion turbines, they dribble it into our pipelines. You know, that is attractive to them because you can't put a combustion turbine in your backyard or at your business or your campus or your city Department of Public Works location. Only the gigantic fossil fuel companies that already own these big combustion turbines can do that. So they'd love to put it into those combustion turbines and not have any of us talk about using fuel cells or electrolyzers.
Wow. Well, we have covered a lot of ground, Nathan. That is a fascinating journey from the idea of taking advantage of the fluctuations of prices on the grid to generate hydrogen in a clean way. And then that leads to discussion of democratization of the grid and who gets to set those rules. It's a fascinating conversation. I really appreciate your coming on and taking the time to chat. So Nathan, is there any place people can go look about grid hydrogen, or is this concept still kind of nascent in formation?
Yeah, I'd say it's nascent. It's formative. I actually started a company called Grid Hydrogen LLC. I started that in the first week of January. So I'm saying that
this year.
This year.
Good for you.
And I'm just putting that out there for full disclosure. Mm-hmm. You know, I'm not advertising it or anything like that, but it's time for asking questions about it. It's time for vetting that idea. You know, I put out there basically a positive feedback idea, mm-hmm. that if you take grid renewables and value them by creating hydrogen, storing it, and then redispatching, what you're doing is you're preferentially selecting for renewables on the grid, as you are also undermining and undercutting the model for fossil fuel peakers, and that forms a positive feedback that will promote more grid renewables from coming on, and that could be a positive feedback could rapidly lead to a 100% renewable grid. Now, that idea needs to be vetted. Short circuits to that hypothetical feedback loop need to be put out there. The experts need to say, this is how that won't work. And so for now, I think we just need to have that conversation on what happens if and when hydrogen comes onto the electric grid. That's the question we all need to be asking.
Well, so related, do you have a Twitter handle that people should follow if they want to keep up with this discussion?
Well, my personal Twitter is Nathan P. Boston, so you can always follow, you know, folks can follow that. And there is basically Grid Hydrogen is a Twitter. Yeah. The hashtag Grid Hydrogen, there's also the handle at Grid Hydrogen, which is the one that, you know, I basically started in January. But, you know, electrolytic hydrogen is a hashtag that could be used. Uh-huh. You know, look for the hashtags. Talk about the hydrogen and not necessarily the colors, but where is it coming from and where is it going to?
Wow. Well, fascinating. Well, Nathan, thank you so much for taking the time to come on. It's an interesting discussion. What I'll do is put up some of these links on the MCAN blog. So you can, dear listener, if you want to go find that, check it out. If you have questions or ideas, please send us an email to podcast@massclimateaction.net. Let us know what we ought to be talking about. You're probably listening to this podcast on your smartphone using a modern podcast distribution app. Please ask all of your friends to listen to us on their favorite modern podcast distribution app, because we're there. Just search for the Climate Minute under Mass Climate Action. We want to thank D.R. Tucker for his continuing research support. We want to close where we always close by saying that we recognize the necessity of personal accountability for our actions, that we accept responsibility for building a durable future, that we believe it's our patriotic duty as citizens to speak out. Because of that, we have to insist that the United States transform its energy sector over the next decade under a just and equitable plan that uses regulation, investment, and a price on carbon that respects environmental justice communities. A price on carbon that respects environmental justice communities to safeguard our future. So, Nathan, thank you so much. I said you were an idea man, and I guess you are. Thank you so much for being here.
Thank you, Ted.
Thanks for everyone for listening. We'll talk again soon. Bye-bye.
Very cool.